6 minutes past 11. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Ankton. Glad you could join us. Governor Jesse Ventura's agenda for this spring's legislative session was really pretty simple when you think about it. Pass what he calls a sensible, smallish bonding bill, cut license tab fees, set aside some money for transportation projects, send a rebate check back to taxpayers, and put the unicameral issue on the November election ballot. But legislators have other ideas. Faced with another huge surplus, projected to be about $1.8 billion, they're talking about permanent tax cuts and increased spending on a range of programs. Unicameral is in trouble, and the governor's choice to head the Public Service and Commerce Departments has already been rejected. Well, Governor Ventura has come by today to discuss what's been happening at the state capitol and to take your questions. We invite you to give us a call here with your questions for Governor Ventura, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Morning, Governor.
Good morning, Gary. How are you today?
Just fine. Maybe I can learn how to tell time here before the hour is over with.
Your job's getting like mine. I rarely look at my watch because I'm so busy going from meeting to meeting to meeting, and before I know it, it is 11 minutes after 6 in the evening. I thought you pulled one on me here. I thought, geez, the day went fast today, and I'm doing this in the evening.
Well, it does seem like the experiment with tripartisan government's a little rockier this year than it was last year. Am I right about that?
Yeah, because, you know, you have to remember it's probably, and first thing I want to comment on, did you notice all the press here today? I mean, all the press are just hanging around here like vultures. They're waiting for that. They're waiting for that story to happen. I want to make that clear, so when they write it tomorrow, they know they heard it here first. You know that they were here listening. That it wasn't part of any breaking news conference. They're all here today. It's amazing. Cameras and writers and all that. But is it? You have to remember that I'm fearful. You know, I mean, there's a fear about me because if I'm successful, there could be more Jesse Ventura is on the horizon of politics, and that creates fear in the two-party system because they definitely work very hard to ensure that third parties are never successful, and so they will continue to do so, you know, to make sure the third parties aren't successful. So it's really not surprising, and I sit on an island. You know, I have no one elected with me. Myself and Governor Angus King of Maine are the two independent governors in the United States of America, and Angus told me how it would go. You know, Angus is in his second term now. I might add he was elected initially with about the same amount I was, and then his second term he was overwhelmingly elected for re-election against, I think, 6 candidates, Democrats and Republicans, and Angus is an independent. But Angus warned me that it would happen. He said, one week the Republicans will be your friend and the Democrats will hate you, and then the next week it'll switch. His record is 48 hours of having him do the complete 360. So I'm hoping I can break that record and see if I can do it in 24.
Now, unicameral, you sent out a call on your radio program on Friday to people suggesting that if they actually want to see a vote on the unicameral legislature, they should contact their legislators, and best anybody can tell, hardly anyone's called. Does anybody actually care about this issue?
Well, they should. They should, because if they continue to complain about government, complain about high taxation, complain about, you know, gridlock government and the things and the way it operates, it's the system that's bad. It's not the individual legislator. You know, I take a bad rap often, but people say I criticize legislators. No, I don't. I rarely criticize legislators. I criticize the system that we're all operating under. I think the system can be so much better. I think a unicameral is a better way to go. It's far more people-friendly. The bicameral system with the conference committees is very much lobbyist and special interest and insider-friendly. And if the people choose not to respond to this, because they have to remember that that legislators generally, you know, they're in a 2-year election cycle, many of them, so they only look 2 years out. That's all the farther they look out, is what do I have to do before my next election? And so they respond very mightily to the public and what public sentiment is. And if people decide that they don't want this opportunity to choose, which I don't believe, because everywhere I've gone, it's been 80 to 90 to 100% people saying, yeah, we'd like the opportunity to choose on this. And we'd all be winners in the end, because it's very simple, Gary. We have a presidential election coming this fall, which is going to create interest and creates higher voter turnout. We in Minnesota can be proud that the 98 election, we have the highest voter turnout in the United States, slightly over 60%. Now, put that in the perspective of your high school sports team. If you went 6-4, do you think you'd win the conference title? No. So 6 people vote in Minnesota, 4 people don't. And to me, we have to do things to bring those 4 people back into the system. And I think in light of a presidential election this fall, if unicameral gets put on the ballot, an education will take place. Because then both the bicameral and the unicameral supporters will have to go very strong on educating the public about how both systems work. And then I think you'll get intrigue from voters to come out and make a choice on which system they would prefer. But you have to remember, there's a lot of people in government that enjoy apathy. They thrive upon apathy. They don't want high voter turnouts. It's much easier to win an election with a low voter turnout with your core special interest groups rather than these 40% that have been turned off by our system. So this is bigger than simply putting unicameral on the ballot. This is an opportunity for people to take an active role and be re-engaged in government again. And if the people of Minnesota don't want that opportunity, then they shouldn't be crying or whining a year from now to me.
Now, some of the opponents to the light rail project over in Hennepin County say that Hennepin County voters should have an opportunity to vote on that, to take a second look at that. Would you support a referendum?
No, not a bit, and I'll tell you why. It's only $100 million. Are we going to have a referendum on every $100 million project that we have in the state? You going to hold a referendum for all that? $100 million projects? If we're going to start doing that, then there's no reason to have a representative government. We'll just put everything $100 million, because that's all light rail is going to cost us.
Well, it costs the state that, but the total cost is substantially more.
Sure, but that's, well, let me ask you this, Gary. If you and I were going to buy something worth $600, and if I put $500 in and you put $100 in, would you buy in? If I put $500 up and you only had to put $100 up, would you buy into that? I would. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what light rail is. We, the state of Minnesota, are only having to put in $100 million for something that's going to be worth 500 and some million. If we don't get it, rest assured, I was out to Denver. Denver will be happy to take that money. Denver's already expanding their light rail to 5 lines it's going to be when they're all done. They just passed a $1 billion bonding bill for highways and rail system, because they're way in front of us when it comes to transportation. And believe me, this is not a liberal or conservative issue. This is an economic issue. If we fall farther behind on transportation economically, it's going to hurt the state of Minnesota, because it's going to be that much more difficult. Look at the polls in the Star Tribune this weekend. Over 62% are in favor of rail. And well over, and that's the lowest of all of them. And what people need to understand is that just because we get rail doesn't mean we're not going to support highway funding. My total proposal is multimodal. That'll handle both highways, improving, getting rid of the bottlenecks. It'll handle bringing in mass transportation. I mean, people ought to jump on board right now when they look at the price of gas. You've got a group of legislators that want to force you into cars. And then they won't reduce license tabs, so if they force you into a car, they don't give you the opportunity to use any type of mass transit, then you got to pay these exorbitant license tabs, which they don't support, lowering them. Isn't that kind of strange? They want to make you drive a car, and then they want to make you make an extra car payment, the price of a license tab, and not give you the opportunity to make a choice on your transportation.
So,
it's interesting.
But in terms of people voting and so on, you'd like to see them vote on the unicameral.
Well, it's also different. Unicameral is a constitutional issue. It's changing what government will be. It's not simply voting on a spending issue. That's why we have representative government. You elect people to represent you. And then if you don't like how they represent you, hopefully you'll vote them out of office. That's how it works. unicameral is the Constitution. What will our government be? There's quite a bit of difference between what our government will be and simply a spending issue. They're apples and oranges. They don't even belong in the same crate.
On the license tab thing, will you accept something less than the $75 cap that you proposed?
Well, I'd have to see it. You know, to me, it's, you know, there's another issue where we cut off our nose in spite of our face, because we have a lot of people go register their cars in other states so they can get their car a lot cheaper. We're right on the border of Wisconsin, and you can register your car in Wisconsin. Well, you know what else we lose then? We lose the sales tax on that car if it gets registered in Wisconsin. That sales tax then goes to Wisconsin. You know, and so you got to look at the broad picture of the whole thing, and philosophically you have to look at it, Gary. When you get your driver's license, do they make you bring in your tax return to show how much money you make? And is your driver's license based upon your income? No. If you go out and get a fishing license, is it based upon how expensive your fishing equipment is? No. If you go out hunting, is it based upon how expensive your shotgun is? No. You're simply going out and purchasing a licensed right to use our lakes, rivers, and fields to hunt and fish in. Well, driving should be the same way. You shouldn't be based upon how expensive your car is. You've already been penalized for that. You've been penalized by the sales tax when you purchase the car. Why should your license be based on how expensive the automobile is? And you always hear the democratic philosophy, the ability to pay. Well, I'm tired of that, because that's simply penalizing people for being successful. And who's to say someone doesn't live very modestly, but their dream is to have a beautiful car? Well, then they're to be penalized for that? They should have to pay more simply because they buy a new car? It's ridiculous. It should be a flat rate.
Governor Jesse Ventura is our guest this hour, and let me give you the number here. Don't call, though, because all our lines are busy. We'll work our way through some callers, and then we'll take your call as well, because we'd like to get your question on. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Tammy, go ahead, please.
Hi, Mr. Ventura.
Hi, Tammy. How are you?
Okay. I'm going to tell you who my legislator is first, but don't laugh too hard. Phyllis Kahn.
Sure.
And she's sitting on the committee, and I call her regularly. I vote in primaries. I'm a freak, okay?
No, you're not. You're a citizen that's doing their duty.
My grandma would have wanted me to vote whenever I could vote, so
sure.
I always vote.
Yeah, good for you. Keep
and she
up.
Couldn't vote when she was a young girl.
That's right.
And I call this woman all the time, and she doesn't care, so it doesn't work. I have no representation the way it is.
Well, you know,
so I'm in favor of, I don't know why we can't at least discuss this and cut the, we have as many as California.
We have more than California, Tammy. We have about 60 to 70 more legislators than California does. Right now, our population is slightly over 4 million. California's is over 33 million, and we have 60 to 70 more legislators than California does.
And how would unicameral make legislators more or less responsive to the people?
Because there won't be the hidden conference committees. Every vote will be taken out on the open floor. Every vote, an amendment to a bill, must be voted on by the full body, not voted on by a committee, not done in the back room. All amendments, like right now, you may have a great bill that is supportive, that you want to support. It comes out of conference committee. It could have four amendments on that bill that you don't like. You have to simply vote it up or down. You're then put in a position, well, do I vote for the original bill, which I support, and allow these other four things to go into law with it, or do I vote against it because of these other four things? When it comes out of that final conference committee, you're simply a vote of up or down. You get nothing on the amendments that go into that bill or all the things attached, and that's where the deal making takes place. That's where you get things put onto bills that have really nothing to do with the bill, many times. In a unicameral, everything is voted out. You know what will happen? The big difference, it's like what happened in Commissioner Min's case. I was offered a deal. I was told that if Commissioner Min would resign, they would do quietly give him 45 days to find another job, and that we could find a replacement in that 45 days. I could have taken that deal quietly. Both the commissioner and I said, no, we're going to make them do this like the unicameral legislature. We're going to make them go out on the floor and pull the lever, so that they're all on the record, those that voted for him and those that voted against him, so the public will see clearly where they stood on the issue. And the commissioner and I, or the former commissioner and I, were both on the same table with that. We said, nope, we're going to make them. We're not going to do a deal like the conference committee in the back room where he quietly leaves. And like one quote I was given, Gary, was, this is going to cause the governor a big headache. Well, let me assure you of something. I'll give you a good quote. Here's a quote for all the media here. I don't get headaches, I give them.
Are you still pretty bitter about that, Dale?
I'm not bitter at all. I'm not bitter. It's something that happened. The state of Minnesota is the one that suffers the loss over the petty politics that were played there. You know, and that's all was because they never brought up his qualifications. No one came forward ever and said Steve Min is unqualified to do this job. They just simply didn't like the fact. And again, it's an example of put your money where your mouth is. We were cutting down government. We were combining two departments, putting it under one commissioner, and they got offended over that and didn't want to do it. So they talk the talk when it comes to downsizing government like unicameral, but do they walk the walk? I don't think so. When it comes time to do it, they're nowhere to be found.
Ms. Bierman, your question, please.
Yes, our class is wondering what your main reason for supporting unicameralism, especially with so many important government issues out there in the state of Minnesota.
Well, unicameral would be simple. All they got to do is put it on the ballot, and then when they go out of session, let the debates begin. It'll be exciting. It'll run all fall when we're done with all these other issues. They could have been done with unicameral in the first week. They could have stood up and said, yes, the people deserve the right to choose on this, pass it out, shoot it out, put it on the ballot, finished with it, over. We're still dealing with all the other issues. Believe me, unicameral, I don't focus my time on it that much. In fact, I'm done with it, really. It's in the hands of the people and the legislators now. I've done everything I can, so I'm focused on all the other issues. We're working towards, and let's remember something. This is also a capital bonding year. Here's another problem we face, is that legislators seem to believe that these two cross over every year. We did a biannual budget last year, which all three entities of government agreed upon. Now, biannual, for those of you that don't understand out there, which this is MPR, so most do, but biannual means every 2 years. So we have a budget in place for 2 years. This is not supposed to be a budget year. This is supposed to be a capital bonding year. Yet, for some reason, it's an election year. So it's not going to be just capital bonding. They're going to come back. They're going to tinker with the budget. They're going to twist it around, do this and do that, which causes all these Band-Aid scratches and bleeding, which then you end up with everything getting thrown out of kilter. We have a biannual budget. Let's live with it. Next year, we do another one. Many of these issues should be brought up next year when we do our next budget, but they allow the two to cross over. You end up with bonding issues during budget years, and you end up with budget issues during bonding years. And course, that creates a big problem.
Of course, Representative Abrams, the House Tax Committee chair, said, that's not correct, that in fact every year, as far as he can ever recall, there's always been some give and take, that bonding years is
always doesn't make it right. That's just the way they operate. If they try it the other way, I think we'd find a much more efficient government.
But they also have, and you have, a projected $1.8 billion surplus.
And it's projected. And it's just a projection right now. We do have $500 million that's in the bank that wouldn't even be there. If they'd have listened to me last time, I didn't cap the rebate. They capped it. The legislature capped it at $1.3 billion. We ended up actually getting in $1.8. So that $500 will be sent back again this summer. It should have already gone back last year. Should have gone back last year. Now, projections are just that. If you're going to deal off projections, you can get yourself in serious trouble, because projections are based upon a strong economy. Would you agree with me that our economy is faltering a little bit right now, that it's becoming a little more shaky? The stock market has now dipped below 10,000 and is hovering at the 10,000 mark. If if the economy takes a turn for the worst, these so-called projected surpluses will disappear in a second, and there will be no surpluses. So, to me, basing your decision on projections, that's like predicting, well, let's project, well, it's like go back to my election. If I had ran on projections, I'd have dropped out of the race. Because not one expert, not one newspaper, not one prognosticator predicted that Jesse Ventura would become the governor. So if I believed in those projections, I would have dropped out of the race and never became governor. But I didn't believe in projections. I believed when people go in and vote, that's like at the end of the biannual budget. Here's how much money you truly have.
Now, can Minnesotans still count on a rebate this summer?
Yeah, I think so. Sure, absolutely. The $500 million that they should have got last summer, because both the House is in favor of it, the Senate's in favor of it, and I'm in favor of it. So it's just rounding out the edges and how it'll return. And I would guess they would probably get it a little sooner this year. They should get it in about June or July.
Now, both House and Senate are talking about permanent tax cuts as well as the rebate.
Again,
now, quite a difference in bills, of course, and approaches, but...
Yep.
Are you ready to sign on to some kind of permanent tax relief as well?
Well, I've already signed on to permanent tax relief. License tabs.
Well, instead of the license
tabs. Yeah, but that's not instead of. They're eliminating the license tabs. The House isn't counting on them at all. Like I said, here you have a body that wants to force you into the automobile. They want you to pay $2 a gallon for gas, which is what it's going up to, right? And yet they want you to pay these exorbitant license tab fees too, of $400 and $500 a year, and not give you an option to take mass transit in any way. Force you into your cars because they're going to provide no money for mass transportation. You know, and it's just fix and build highways. That's the mindset. Well, no city in America has ever built their way out of congestion. I guess we'll be the first one, according to that mindset. We'll be the first one to do it. I got to see it. But again, permanent. Here's the other point I want to make. I want to permanently reform property taxes. I sent Commissioner Matt Smith has been out holding town meetings throughout the state of Minnesota, and it's come back very clearly that Minnesotans want permanent tax reform of their property tax system. You can't do that overnight. It's taken tens of 20s of years to get our property tax system into the mess it's in. Do you understand yours, Gary? When you get that form and you go through it, do you understand it?
I don't understand much of anything, Governor.
No, yes. Come on. Don't be light on yourself. Don't feel bad. I don't either. When you get that form, it is such a boggle of mess when you look at who taxes you, how much, where it's going, what it's paying for. You have no idea. You don't have a clue what all that's going to. It's been very clear that people want meaningful property tax reform. Well, the system won't let us do that, because the system requires an election this fall to do meaningful property tax reform. We have an opportunity now because we've got this budget surplus. If they simply stick with the budget that we have right now and go into the new year with a new budget, we will be able to do meaningful property tax reform. If they tamper with that budget right now, give across-the-board tax cuts, which we already did. We cut income tax last year, the most of any state in the United States of America. We gave back the biggest rebate in United States history last year, and we're going to give another rebate this summer of even more money. If they would simply live within the biannual budget that had been agreed upon for 2 years, we could put together and come forward with meaningful property tax reform. But that's probably not going to happen because of the system. They're all up for re-election this fall, so therefore they have to make decisions based upon what they can put on campaign literature to ensure the power struggle. That's what you have here, is the power struggle between the Democrats and the Republicans. Who maintains control, who gets control, and who fights for that control. That's what it's all about. It isn't about doing what's best necessarily for Minnesotans in the long run. It's about a 2-year window in a power struggle of getting elected.
Don't you think many of the legislators, though, are acting on principle, Governor? I mean, obviously, if you're a politician, you're interested in good politics.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, if you want to run again, getting yourself reelected.
Yeah.
But
well, that's
you seem to be suggesting that that's the only motivation
not at all. But it's the system that corrupts it. It's not them corrupting it. It's the system. We're going back to unicameral again. Unicameral would be a 4-year term. so you wouldn't face an election for 4 years. You take a look at a rookie legislator right now. They get elected, right? They spend the first year getting acclimated, learning how it works. They spend the second year running for re-election, right? Now, if they get re-elected, they can actually come back and do some work the third year, and then the fourth year, they're running for re-election again. So that means 3 out of 4 years, they're not doing the people's work. Where if in the unicameral system, you'll get elected for a 4-year term, you can come in and get acclimated the first year, you can spend the second and third years working on the people's business, and you won't have to run for re-election till your fourth year to get re-elected if you so desire. Maybe you'll get everything done in those 2 years and you can go back to the private sector. But that's unheard of, isn't it? Serving and then going back to what you used to do seems to me, maybe I'm just spitballing here a little bit, but it seems to me our country was founded upon that many, many, many years ago, coming in and serving, when you're done serving, going back to what you used to do. But that's old-time government, isn't it? Today it's, let's get reelected, let's make careers out of this, and let's spend 25 and 30 years. Do you realize that the speaker, that the majority leader in the Senate, has been there longer than when I deployed overseas in the Navy? And I did that in February of 1971, was my first deployment overseas. And the majority leader in the Senate took office January of 71. How many jobs have I had since January of 1971? Let's see, I did 4 years in the Navy, got discharged. I spent a year at college, wrestled for 11 years, became a broadcaster for wrestling for 4 or 5 years, broadcasted NFL football, became a talk radio host, did 11 different movies, and yet this person's been doing the same thing for that entire career. That's what we're at today.
Let's get back to our callers here. Sa, go ahead, please.
Good morning, Governor. I really commend you on your effort.
Thank you.
That you're trying to make the changes. I support you on the unicameral legislature system, the license tab. I think it's tried to match the Wisconsin's. I think it's about $45 per car.
Yes, it is.
Makes sense.
Yep, I think it is.
And also property taxes. It should be like stocks. If you own stocks, you don't pay on the stocks you own. You pay on the stocks that you sell in profit.
I agree. I would love to see property taxes frozen at what you purchase it for. Why should you be penalized for fixing up your property? You know, here's another example of government penalizing those that do the right thing and rewarding those that do the wrong thing. You buy a home and you fix it up. Well, what does government do? They penalize you. You pay more. If you buy that same house, allow it to deteriorate, government rewards you. You pay less. Now, what kind of mind thought is that? That's crazy thinking. It's no common sense at all to that. You shouldn't be penalized for doing the right thing. You know, you should be rewarded for doing the right thing.
Now, apparently there's a big rally at the Capitol this week calling for legislation which would at least cap the increase that assessors could impose each year. Would you support legislation like that?
Yeah, I think I would. I can't say because I haven't studied it yet completely. I'd like to get rid of assessors. I'd like to go a step farther, get rid of assessors.
Mm-hmm.
Why not have the property what it sold for? That's your assessor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you purchase a property, you've deemed its value by what you bought it for. Then if you turn around and sell it, whoever buys the property, how can they argue? If it's assessed for what they purchased it for, they're the ones that set the value, and that way you're not penalized for improving the property. Now, there should be a check to that, of course. If you take an existing house and you add a 2,500 expansion, square foot expansion on it, well then yes, there should be a mode for taxing for that, because but if you simply replace the roof or finish off the basement or improve the house that you live in without expanding it or making it larger, I think it's ridiculous that we allow assessors to come and penalize you. You've already been taxed. You've bought the material. You know, if you buy the roofing material, you pay a sales tax to buy that. Now you're simply using it for what you purchased it for, and they're going to tax you again for using it. What, are you supposed to stack it up in the corner and let it sit there?
Mm-hmm.
It's ridiculous.
Will that be part of your property tax overhaul next year?
I won't speak on it now because I want to let Commissioner Smith come forward with his recommendations from his town meetings and that, and I would never want to jump in ahead of him. He's been the one working on it. He's going to bring all that to me in May or June. And if we get the opportunity then to overhaul the property tax system, I will take his recommendations. But certainly my own thoughts will go into those recommendations at that time.
Bob, your question, please.
Governor, as you should know, there was a major opinion page article yesterday in the Star Tribune titled Living in Public. And that article pointed out yet once again the disgraceful homeless situation that we have in Minnesota. As that article made clear, the housing facilities for the homeless are grossly inadequate in two respects. One, we don't begin to have enough facilities to house the homeless. And secondly, some of the facilities that we do have are grossly inadequate of themselves. So at the same time, you and the legislators are competing as to how much of our tax money to give back.
Wait a minute. My question to you, obviously,
Governor,
you're not.
Are you going to do about it?
I already did something about it. If you were really up on what's happening, you could call up and speak with a little more intelligence. We have TANF funds that we get from the federal government. I have just allocated in my proposal $83 million dedicated to housing. So I suggest you educate yourself on what I'm doing over there before you call up and chastise me. Kit Hadley and the housing people met with me. They were ecstatic. I caught them totally off guard. They had no idea that my focus was going to be on housing with that TANF money. $83 million. So before you call up again and start chastising me about your pet cause here, which is affordable housing for homeless people, well, homeless people need to go out and get a job, too. There's a tremendous amount of jobs out there right now. I was just told there's 44,000 jobs in Minnesota right now that aren't being filled. And so I don't want to hear this, that there's nothing available for people to go out there. Pull yourselves up by your bootstraps. Go out and get a job. I've allocated $83 million to affordable housing in that TANF money that we get from the federal government. I'm doing my part. So next time you call, pal, have your facts straight and know what's going on.
Now, a lot of homeless people already have jobs.
Well, there's 44,000 additional ones out there. Get a second one. I mean, I get yelled at for doing two jobs, Gary. Whenever I try to go out and hold down a second job, I get legislators over there trying to stop me from doing it. That's the American way. If you want to hold down, you can hold. Nobody holds you back. Hold down a couple jobs. That's how you become successful.
Now, on that issue, there was some legislation, and I'm afraid to say I don't know where it currently stands, which would essentially impose on future governors the same rules regarding outside income that other state employees are under. Would you support that legislation?
Well, it has no effect on me because it's according to ethics. You have to be, someone has to be gaining from you doing this job. Anything I've done, there's been no conflict of interest. The World Wrestling Federation has no interest in our government policies in Minnesota. Me writing a book, I actually, you know, and that's under a misdirection there a little bit too. I signed that book deal when I was governor-elect, and I hadn't taken an oath. I hadn't raised my hand when I did that. And the point is, that has no bearing on how I govern. And will I support it, it would have no effect on what I do because I'm not doing anything unethical. And the thing for state employees is you have to be doing something unethical. You have to be using your job to benefit someone out there because of the job that you're doing. That's how the wording of it goes, because I talked to my attorney and he said it would really have no bearing. We're very careful about what we allow you to do so that it doesn't fringe upon that at all. And he told me this would have no fringe on that at all.
Jenzi, your question, please.
Good morning, Governor Ventura.
Hi, Jenzi. How are you doing? I'm doing very well, thank you. Couldn't be better.
That's great. Well, anyway, I'd like to turn our attention to the farm crisis. And I definitely have always agreed with you that people should assume responsibility for themselves. And I also think that we Minnesotans need to take care of each other. And I have not seen a whole lot of attention paid by the news media or most politicians to what, if anything, us ordinary citizens here in states that have a lot of farmers, what we can do to kind of help farmers out of the jam they're in. And I know a lot of it is in the control of federal legislation about farming.
Very much so.
Yeah, but aside from really leaning on our guys in Congress in Washington to pass legislation that's going to help out the farmers long term rather than just keep putting short term band-aids on what's a bigger problem than can just be getting emergency fixes thrown at it. What, if anything, do you think we can do to kind of give farmers a boost?
Well, and again, you know, farmers and all farm families hold down two jobs lots of times, too, today. What we can do, what is surprising, we need to bring up the technology in greater Minnesota, that superhighway, the computer world. We have to ensure that that gets out to rural Minnesota, because when Director Barkley went out there, surprisingly, it wasn't farm and crop growing that was their main concern. Their main concern was technology and having the ability to have it out in greater Minnesota. Of course, we were set back when they got rid of Commissioner Min, because Commissioner Min and Commissioner Fisher were spearheading that operation, but that wasn't important. It was more important to relieve him of his duties because they were offended over a executive decision that I made last spring. I guess they would think I should bring them into special session to consult them, you know, on what I'm going to do when I have the executive right to do it. It's my job to take care of the executive end of government. But getting back to the farm issue, also opening up free trade. I think it's extremely important that we continue on the track with China, because China is 20% of the world market. And rest assured, if we put up barriers against China, well, China's going to go somewhere else then. They're going to go to Brazil. They're going to go to another foreign country. And they face it, they have a lot of people over there that need to be fed. And in an agricultural world like we have here in Minnesota, they are a natural trading partner for us. I'm already setting up a trade mission to go to China. I will be going over there, and I've been asked by the federal government to take a lead on trade issues. When I was in Washington at the NGA, so I will be taking that bull by the horns and being one of the leaders in international trade and the global economy, and I think it's only going to help Minnesota.
Deborah, your question, please. Deborah, hello, Deborah.
Hello.
You're on the air.
I don't know if my comments are properly directed to, you know, the governor or the legislature, but it just seems like, in a state with a budget, I know, a projected budget surplus, you know, we seem to have such a problem with funding our schools in greater Minnesota, and even it seems like some of the bigger school districts, and it just seems like, you know, really hard on the parents. I mean, we're cutting programs, we're cutting teachers, and I guess I look at Israel, well, like what the governor was saying before, you know, people should be rewarded for their hard work. I mean, I see parents sending kids off to school, you know, prepared to learn, eager to learn. Our school districts, you know, we have national merit scholars in this state, you know, great athletes, great performing arts. I mean, people are trying really hard, and it just seems like we're always being told to make do with less. And
well, all I can say is my biannual budget last year was the largest boost to public education in the last decade or more. You know, we sent the money out there. Now it's up to the schools to use that money and to use it effectively at the local level. So, again, I think it's very easy to attempt to hold the state government responsible, but you also have to look to your local school boards and those elected officials, because they likewise determine how that money will be spent on the local level. So hold them accountable.
A lot of the school district officials will say, though, that, yes, the basic formula was increased substantially, and they, you know, thank the Lord for that, they say. But on the other hand, a lot of these special programs were kind of folded into that, and as a result, when you add in increased enrollment or declining enrollment, they end up with, well, virtually no money to work with.
Another thing that I'm leading the charge on, and I met with the vice president on Saturday about it, is the federal government's commitment to funding special ed. They agreed when that special ed bill was passed and mandated that they would pick up 40% of it. Well, they've only picked up 12 to 13% tops. If they go to that 40%, that's going to free us up for an additional $200 million plus that we in Minnesota will be able to use if the federal government will fulfill their end of the bargain. I met with the vice president for 50 minutes, and that was quite something, Gary, to sit in a room of just he and I. There was no one else in that room. Imagine getting a 50-minute audience with a potential president, because, you know, it's between him and Governor Bush now, and you know, I'm not going to call who's going to win at all. That's up to their campaigns and what they do, but it was a great, I took it as a terrific sign when the vice president calls from the airplane Friday night, changes his entire schedule to meet with me Saturday morning, and special ed was one of our main things we talked about, and if we can get them, and he is committed to that, if he follows through and pays for the federal 40% on that, that's going to free us up for $200 million more plus dollars that we'll have for our, that we can dedicate to our public school funding here in the state of Minnesota, which is huge.
I don't mean this to even, well, it's going to sound sarcastic, and I don't mean it that way. Do you see yourself in the role, or could you end up in the role as a kind of presidential kingmaker here? I imagine George W. Bush will be coming by, and you are ascribed or attributed to having a lot of influence with that that middle voter, that independent voter that both sides are trying to lure.
Well, I think you judge that by the meetings that are set up and what happened with the vice president coming to town. Obviously, he feels I'm an important person to talk with. I think that you have to be honest. The independent voter determines who wins. Because you've got roughly the same amount of people on the Democratic left as you've got the same amount of people on the Republican right. And it really what needs to be made clear, they're minorities. Polls in Minnesota show that over 60% of Minnesotans don't identify with either party. So you've got a 60% out there of a potential that you've got to get. So that tells you very clearly that they are the voters that determine who wins. And if indeed I am part of winning those 60%, I think candidates would be pretty darn foolish not to to come and meet with me and to get my perspective on things. Because, again, the Democrats and Republicans are minorities. If you add them both together, they're only 40%. That's less than half of the people in Minnesota don't even identify with these two parties that, that the media and that they would have you believe are in a majority, when in the reality is they're a minority.
3-4 years ago, could you have imagined yourself being in a position where the presidential candidates would come hat in hand to Jesse Ventura?
No. Not at all. And I couldn't imagine that I go out to the White House now. And in fact, when I went to the NGA, I had fun. The president's got a great sense of humor. He does, President Clinton. And when I was out there this year, I was seated at the very table with the First Lady. And I told the president at the end of the night, I said, gee, had I known that just by quitting the Reform Party, I'd get bumped up to sitting with the First Lady, I said I'd have did it a year ago. Because a year ago, I was kind of in the middle and towards the left at the back, you know, and didn't have that prominent seat. This time, I was seated right there when they got up and made toasts. I actually touched glasses with the president on a toast. That's how close I was. And, gee, just by quitting the Reform Party, I got boosted up a little bit. So, yeah, no, I didn't imagine it, but I relish the position, and I enjoy it. I think I speak for what is now becoming a regular word, the centrists. Those of us in the center, that's a real word, centrists. We take the best from the right, we take the best from the left, and we're common sense. That's a centrist.
Might Minnesota get something out of this unique position?
I hope so. I'm certainly going to exploit it. I certainly am going to focus some attention on Washington. Why not? We've got it until November. I'd be off. I wouldn't be representing my state as their governor if I didn't.
Stephanie, your question, please.
Yes, Governor. Jesse, I live on a farm, and my husband raised hogs in confinement at one time. I applaud your veto of a really bad feedlot bill, was it last year?
Yes.
And I hope you might get ready to veto another one. There's a really bad one coming. Senator Dill really thinks he has your approval, I believe, because he's pretty much said that in a farm newsletter for changes he puts forward. And one of them is changing the finishing hog animal unit from a 0.4 to a 0.25, which will result in almost doubling of the number of large hogs allowed at these sites. Do you, Do you think you would sign a bill like that?
Well, I again will go to Commissioner Hugeson and my people on staff, and of course I'll get their opinion on it. But for the senator to say that that I'm going to approve everything, how did he vote on the MIN situation? Maybe that's a question someone should ask him, because, you know, all of them voted to take away one of my most brightest commissioners. So, you know, and I have a terrific memory.
Yeah, but you have said repeatedly, Governor, that you don't want these issues linked like that.
Oh, I don't.
So you wouldn't take revenge?
You know me better than that, Gary.
We should note for those of you listening that there is
a twinkle in my eye.
A twinkle on your eyes.
No, I like keeping people guessing also. You have to remember that politics is war. It's just war without guns. It's tactical war, and I thrive upon it. And so I won't give up my positions and let them know what I think about everything. But I think it's something that one should keep in mind, is that, you know, they did something unprecedented for 50 years. They didn't allow me to choose a commissioner who was highly qualified to do the job. And now they're even stepping forward and saying that they're going to demand I do proclamations. Well, I think they're overstepping their bounds between the legislative and executive branches of government. And if they want to say what I do proclamations on, then fine, they can do them all. Because I get 30 to 50 per month, and I will ship them over to the legislature and let them carry bills on all of them then.
Stacy, a quick question before we wrap up here.
Yes, Governor Ventura, Stacy Martin. My question is about light rail and just rail in general.
Okay.
I lived in Munich, Germany for 7 years, and where they have a fantastic transportation system, along with buses and subways, and they call them the L trains as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm curious to know if you think that part of the reason the legislation, it keeps saying that Minnesota loves their cars, they don't want light rail, they want the highways. I wonder what role car manufacturers, petroleum manufacturers, gas manufacturers, and the lobbyists that work for those groups have, the role they have and the job they have in trying to keep light rail out of Minnesota. And how much money these legislatures receive from these organizations. I would like some study done on that to see how much money these legislatures are receiving from the car manufacturers, the petroleum, the gas
people. Well, Stacy, let me tell you a couple of things right here. Good questions. Excellent. You've lived in Europe. You've seen how great it works and all that. You don't need a car. And like I said, you've got people here that want to keep you in cars and then charge you these exorbitant fees for license tabs as a way to collect money, and you'll have no alternative. All this stuff about Minnesotans won't ride rails, we love our cars. Well, I was out in Denver, and they told me the same arguments were made out there. And as far as I understand, I think I'm right, and Ragsdale out there will let me know, I think Denver's west of Minneapolis. I think my geography is correct. They're even more west than we are. And so if they love their cars out there as even more than we probably do here in Minnesota, if you look the farther west you travel. Well, they were given the same arguments on rail out there. You know what their problem is now? They've put the rail in. They underestimated their ridership. They didn't allocate enough parking. If you're not on the rail by 7:15 in the morning, you can't get on it and park at the park and ride because it's full. They're buying up as much parking as they can possibly get, and the big complaint now is, hey, we want to ride this. Where's the parking so we can? And the point being is, let's go back in history. Back in the early 50s, the Twin Cities, Minneapolis especially, had the best rail system in the world. The best in the world. And what happened? The automotive industry is exactly what Stacy talked about. The automotive industry, the rubber industry for tires, and the petroleum industry came in here and got our politicians and government people to rip up all those trolley tracks, rip up all the mass transit, and literally force us into automobiles. And that is a fact. And now we're stuck with it today, and we're having to reverse ourselves and redo things that should have remained from the 50s on, and had they remained today, we wouldn't be worried about having to put light rail in. We'd have already had it at one point in time.
Not a lot of time left, but if you find at the end of the session that some provision, which essentially would block the light rail, ends up in a bill that you otherwise would support? Do you feel so strongly about this light rail line that you'd veto that bill?
I would have to judge it as it comes across my desk, but I'm not worried about that because that's one of the advantages of the bicameral system. It has to pass both houses, doesn't it? And I don't think that it's going to get out of the Senate.
Abortion restrictions, 24-hour waiting period, if that would find its way into an otherwise acceptable bill, would you go with that?
I want things to stand on their own. I don't want, see, there's the flaw to the bicameral system. They can throw things like these into bills that they have no business being part of. Let them stand on their own 2 feet. The unicameral system will force that to happen. That's why people need to get on board and very much, hey, if bicameral wins, so be it. But you should have the right to choose what you want your government to be this fall. They have an opportunity to do so with the new census coming out, redistricting. Now's the time to do it. And for those legislators that don't want to allow you to have a voice in what government will be, that shows very narrow-mindedness, in my opinion.
The Porsche, is that still up for auction? Or
yeah, because the media, the eBay or whatever it is isn't accurate. They a lot of fraudulent bids on it, and now they're putting it up again to see if we can get some legitimate ones. But you know, the media likes to report it's going to sell for $100,000. They don't bother to see if it's real or not. But then again, do they ever?
Thanks, Governor. Minnesota Governor Jesse Ventura.